This week on Your Western Context, cancel culture strikes at UBC. The Alberta NDP calls referendums undemocratic, and Trudeau allows disgraced MP Marwan Tabara to run in 2019 despite allegations. Also, the media wants Canada to bend to the will of the Chinese government. This is Western Context, episode 175, recorded Friday, June 26th, 2020, Canceling Diversity. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are in again, as we are each and every week, to bring you the news, and in doing so, hopefully remove some media bias and sensationalism along the way.
Yes, we've been doing this for quite some time now, over 3.5 years, and it's amazing to me that we are still able to do this, that the media has not really gotten any better on this issue, because there are lots of stories this week, even in the midst of all that's been going on, that there has been in the media that have not really received the fair coverage that they have deserved, and they've certainly been covered in a way that they probably shouldn't have been.
Indeed, and that's our whole business here at Western Context. We are the podcast that removes the media bias and sensationalism from the news that you see each and every day, and in doing so, hopefully we provide the information and context necessary to put you on the right side of the news. And we're going to begin with our BC story this week, which is a little bit different than normal, but it works.
Yes, and it is a bit of a different BC story for us. Normally I'm talking about something that happens in politics, but this week I'm going to be talking about a story that's happening in academia. And for years now, it's been known that academia in Canada has a liberal bias. Even liberal-leaning professors themselves doing research on the political leanings of university professors have found this to be true. Neil Gross, who is a professor of sociology who used to teach at the University of British Columbia, or UBC, extensively researched the trend of university liberalism in the United States, and he found that up to 60% of American university professors held left-of-center views. Now, given that Canadian society is on the whole more liberal than the United States, it can be extrapolated that a much higher percentage of Canadian professors could be left of center. Now, even Gross, who describes himself as a liberal, says that it's important to have a diverse set of opinions in universities in order to lend legitimacy to the institution, and that, quote, higher education institutions need bipartisan support from politicians and voters if they are going to thrive. Now, with his words in mind, given that he is a professor who is wanting to keep the institution of academia going, it's important to note that in universities we do need a diverse set of opinions, and that if we are to coexist as a society and to de-radicalize our youth and let them critically think about what's going on in the world, that free speech must be a protected tenet in our education system so that students can hear multiple viewpoints and increase their own ideas on different political matters. Now, unfortunately, we're in the age of cancel culture and outrage culture and virtue signaling, and diversity has been corrupted from meaning multiple viewpoints to meaning only one viewpoint being acceptable. Now, we see this all the time in academia these days. UBC, where Neil Gross once taught, provided an example of this earlier this week when Michael Korenberg, who is the chair of their board of governors, was forced to resign last Saturday night, which was only weeks after the UBC, quote, distanced itself from a basketball coach who liked a video criticizing Black Lives Matter on social media. Just liked a video. Didn't even say anything about it, just liked it. Now, a series of tweet barrages from the UBC students group, who call themselves UBC Students Against Bigotry, were said to take credit for the ousting of Korenberg. UBC Students Against Bigotry is a student-led organization that engages in Antifa-style behavior like doxing, stalking, and harassing. And this group was heavily involved in the cancellation of an Andy Ngo talk at UBC as well. Now, in the tweets by this group, Korenberg was called MAGA Mike, accused of enabling far-right extremists at UBC and asking if he supports the white supremacist in the White House and his calls for violence, which is their words, not mine. Now, the reason why the cancel campaign was waged by this account was because Korenberg liked tweets that were favorable to Donald Trump, including those quite simply wishing Trump a happy birthday or other stories that were surrounding Trump's Twitter account at the time, and a tweet by conservative Dinesh D'Souza that called groups like Antifa and Black Lives Matter a, quote, paramilitary wing of the Democrat Party in the U.S. Now, Korenberg could have any reason for liking those tweets, but just because someone likes something on social media does not mean they may fully ascribe to or endorse the behavior exhibited by those people. After all, you can follow people on Twitter just to see what they're saying, not saying that you're agreeing with it, just so that you can follow it to keep in, to keep up with the news. Now, Korenberg maintains that his intention in liking those tweets was to save them to look at later. However, Korenberg did step down from the chair of the Board of Governors with an apology for his social media behavior. He said, quote, "Today I step down as chair of the Board of Governors of UBC. I owe all students, faculty, and staff, and all those who stand against all forms of discrimination, an apology. I do so with all my heart. Over the last 2 weeks, some articles, statements that I liked on Twitter supported regressive voices and took aim at thousands of brave individuals standing up against racism, discrimination, and hatred. While I do not support violence of any kind, I understand how my actions created questions about who I am and what I believed in." Now, upon Korenberg's resignation, Students Against Bigotry immediately celebrated and said that they were not done with their cancel campaigns. The student activists have now stated that their campaign will not end with Korenberg and that they're going to be heading after Dr. Santa Ono, which is the president of UBC, who appears to be next on the next target of the cancellation streak. Now, the CBC took their own spin on this, and they put out an unauthored article that said that Korenberg resigned after, quote, liking racist posts on Twitter, which is a gross oversimplification of what actually happened. And they didn't even show what the posts were so that people could judge for themselves. You'd actually have to dig if you actually found the CBC article. So, if it's clear that we're at a crossroads moment in human history and that political polarization is increasingly dangerous, and it's worrying to see a trend of exclusivity amongst opinions of students at universities, and that there's an ever-growing trend of liberalism that doesn't teach these students to have diversity in their opinions, which is strange given that diversity seems to be the word that a lot of these liberal students and teachers seem to like. Now, it's strange how we're at the point where even just looking at tweets means someone is a racist and should lose their job. And there remains a middle ground between extremes on either side of the political spectrum. It's called the center, and it's where sanity and peace remains. And if academia wants to be taken seriously and legitimately, it should strive towards that center and stop its students from drifting towards the far left.
And this is something that has not only infiltrated academia, it's infiltrated many streams of life in the recent years. And it's really unfortunate that that has happened. You can, you know, I remember a day where, you know, you would go to a library and you would check out some very controversial books on controversial subjects by controversial authors in that very regard. And that was deemed as a very enriching thing to do for people to go to the library and to expand their knowledge and see the other side of the page, so to speak. But if you attempt to do that online, you are indeed at this point in time branded as a racist. And, you know, looking at these commentators mentioned, whether it be Dinesh D'Souza or Andy Ngo, or you could even expand that out to others such as Ben Shapiro or Dennis Prager or even Ann Coulter, many folks on the right who give these kind of talks, if people like those talks on Twitter, they can be lumped into this camp. And there have been cases where others, such as Ben Shapiro, for one example, has gone to give a talk at a university, and the cancel culture at the university has gone so far to pull the fire alarm in order to ensure that his talk wouldn't be able to go forward. And that's the point that these things are at. And we need to just underscore here that the fact that somebody watches or reads the work of someone else doesn't mean that they ascribe to their views. And being able to watch and read stuff that you disagree with is a very important part of expanding your horizons and knowing where your true opinions lie. Because we're at the point in time where people's opinions are assigned to them by the media that they read. And, you know, the media won't tell you this, but, you know, you can tell that pretty much the bulk majority of people out there who have a political opinion, it comes from what the media is talking about. And that's a really unfortunate thing in this day and age. And, you know, as it just so happens, Dinesh D'Souza pretty much puts out a new movie each election year. In 2012, it was Obama's America, and there was also one for Hillary Clinton in 2016. And there's also going to be one for Trump this year, too. So you can see why the prominence of Dinesh D'Souza is rising yet again. And just because someone goes to watch one of his movies or like one of his tweets doesn't mean that they necessarily agree with him. It's just a matter of expanding their own horizons and figuring out what their true opinion is.
Yes, and it's also important to have a look at what people who disagree with you and to look at their opinions to see what other people outside of your own personal political bubble are actually talking about, because it's important to know what people outside of that are actually talking about and what they're discussing about and what's important to them. Because if you don't know anything about what's happening outside of your political bubble, you're not going to be able to grow as a person, and you're going to stay with the same views as you have been. Now, for students, when they're really young, something like this happening is not a good thing at all, because it means that you're not going to grow as a person. You're not going to grow. And for myself, I would think if I was the same person now as I was 10 years ago, I would think that a great tragedy, because in those 10 years, people have grown as a person. People have educated themselves. They've learned more things. They've learned more skills. And that's a part of growing up. And I think that these universities have a due diligence to be able to show diverse set of opinions without having them canceled. And the media going along with this and trying to simplify the issues by calling it liking racist posts on Twitter, when in the end it's tarring the person with the racist word. And as we've seen so often lately, that seems to be the best way to ruin someone's life, is by calling them a racist. And it's something that we've seen more and more over the past few months. And hopefully people will learn to stay calm, and people will learn to accept that other people will not agree with you, and that there is a diverse set of opinions out there that deserve to be respected and that deserve to be heard. Now, there are quite a few opinions that probably should not be heard, but there is quite a... It's not up to the media, and it's not up to academia to pass judgment on those. It's up to the people looking at it to judge for themselves what is acceptable and what is not. And I think that is up to the people, and it should not be something that the media is trying to force down everyone's throats.
Indeed, and that is certainly the age that we're at. It's, as you mentioned, a huge oversimplification of what's going on, and that happens in our Alberta story too. But before we do that, I'll just take a moment to remind our listeners about our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext. And there you can support the podcast monetarily if you so choose to. For $2 a month, or the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media, for $5 a month, the price of a sandwich. You can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you so desire. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, we'll craft 2 Patreon-exclusive articles each month, expanding on our coverage of our show stories from the month, and these articles will, of course, continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $50 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we'll reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. All right, so our Alberta story this week is one, yet again, of oversimplification that carries the headline, Alberta Opposition NDP label referendum bill a covert Jason Kenney power grab. And keep in mind, this is coming from the political party that has Democratic in their name as we move through this story. Following the report from the Fair Deal panel, which we talked about last week on the podcast, the Alberta government has moved quickly to set the stage for the implementation of its recommendations. Now, these recommendations, of course, some of them are wide-sweeping and represent a fundamental change to the way the province would work, so the province wants to tackle some of them with referenda. Bill 26, as it's called, the Constitutional Referendum Amendment Act, is a simple bill that effectively aims to clean up the process of holding referendums in Alberta. And it's really as simple as allowing referendums to be held on government-led initiatives or matters of public interest. Right now, they can only be held on matters related to the Canadian Constitution. The bill also allows for the referendum to be held in conjunction with the provincial or municipal election, standalone, or by mail-in ballot. On Bill 26, Premier Jason Kenney said that Albertans continue to tell us that they want to have a greater say in the politics in this province, and that is what we're doing. This legislation will help us strengthen democracy and increase accountability, giving Albertans a louder voice and a direct impact on the actions of government. Now, the opposition NDP have labeled this a power grab by the UCP in that the government would get to determine what the question wording would be, how, where, and when the referendum would be held, and ultimately what the thresholds for success would be. Now, question wording is the first part of this that needs to be examined when holding a referendum, because this is the whole reason that Canada, federally, has something called the Clarity Acts on the book that was brought in by the Jean Chrétien government after the Quebec referendums. And everybody should know that if you have a referendum and the question isn't clear as to what's going to happen if you vote yes or no, that's a major problem. So it makes sense that the government should have oversight on the wording of the question. How? Of course, referring to municipal and provincial elections that only come around once every 4 years. This means that a referendum is not held at this time. It needs to be held standalone. Failing that, there's also the option for the mail-in ballot option, which worked, of course, well enough in BC's proportional representation referendum. Bill 26 also legally defines what third-party advertisers can do during a referendum and caps their spending at $500,000. Currently, if any Albertan turns on the TV, they'll say union-based advertising encouraging Albertans to tell the premier to not to cut the healthcare system. And there's plenty of spending that goes on regarding political causes outside of an election cycle and even outside of potential referendums that costs more than this $500,000 limit. What's more, if an advertiser goes above the $350,000 limit during a referendum period, they will have to file an audited financial statement. Now, recall that while the NDP was in power, they removed the secret ballot needed for workplace unionization. And what we often see here in Alberta is that the NDP doesn't live up to their name of being a democratic party. Quite frankly, it's super rich of the NDP to claim that the UCP is being undemocratic when more direct democracy is going to be brought to Albertans at the end of the day, not only with these government-initiated referendums, but with the Citizen-Initiated Referenda Act that's going to be tabled this fall. Also, on this, CBC opinion columnist Graham Thompson wrote in a column titled, "Jason Kenney Likes Referendums. Here's Why You Shouldn't." His reasoning comes down to the fact that all we need to do is to look at the UK and see what happened with the Brexit debate, or see the numerous citizens' initiatives in California and other states in the U.S. that, in his words, have reduced the rights of minorities. He also says that if too many important decisions are left to plebiscites, we risk having politicians afraid to pass laws and the public sector bankrupted because politicians can't raise taxes. And that's just the thing. Politicians should always be worried about their jobs and if their constituents will vote them out. If they're worried, they'll be on their toes and less likely to abuse the power that they've been given and overact. All we need to do is look at the excesses of former Premier Alison Redford. There's also the belief that if a government operates driven by and for the people, it's the people at the end of the day who get a better government.
Yes, I think this is something that needs to be looked at a little bit more critically, because the referendums are an option to give the citizens direct democracy. And for those looking to have a bit more control over what their government policy is, referendums are a great way to do that, because if a policy gets a certain threshold of people that are interested in it, then that referendum can have a chance to go forward. And it also gives the governments that may not personally believe in something, but is something that is very popular with the people, to be able to pass that and go forward, because then they can gauge public support on this. And this is something that happened with the BC government doing their proportional representation referendum. And it worked, as you said, quite well for mail-in ballots, even during the Canada Post strike that was happening at the time. And there was an extended period where people could mail in, and it turned out that it was quite a high turnout for this. And this is something that was seen as a win for democracy, even if the people that were advocating for proportional representation didn't get what they wanted at the end of the day. Now, interestingly enough, is that they're trying to call this a power grab when they're wanting to determine wording based on the government. And as you said, after the Quebec referendums, it was clear that all referendums need to have a very clear and concise question as to what they're talking about, because you could word anything in there and have anybody vote yes or no on it, but if you can't understand what the question means, then that raises problems for the legitimacy of the referendum. And it's quite clear that for referendums to be able to pass and for to be able to be acted upon, they need to be clear-cut, and they need to have no distractions as to what they actually are.
Yeah, and, you know, also when it comes to different matters, you know, there are some referendums where 50% plus one vote is good enough, but there are others where you might want something like a 60% vote or a two-thirds majority vote in that sense. And it is up to the government in that case to determine if this is a referendum that's a 50% or if it's going to be a 60% or even a higher margin than that. So it's only natural to afford the government some matter of control on what the referendum questioning should look like. And to say that's undemocratic just completely oversimplifies what was being said on this story. And, you know, I guess that's what the opposition NDP has to criticize in this day and age. And as we said, very rich of them having the name Democratic in their party. But of course, we also do have another story after this. And this one goes back to the 2019 election, which is the epitome of democracy in any country. And this is a follow-up from a couple weeks back on the podcast.
Yes, that's right. And the Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party has been in the news over the past week, and not in a good way. Gerald Butts, who was Justin Trudeau's former principal secretary and political aide, and quite possibly still current political aide, and the architect of both Trudeau campaigns in 2015 as well as 2019, and according to Maclean's, the 14th most powerful Canadian of 2014, well, he was in the news because he shared an anti-American map on Twitter. Now, Butts tweeted the map in response to a tweet by Ian Bremner, who is the president of the Eurasia Group, which is where Butts is currently employed. Butts added the comment, quote, "Here's a helpful guide in navigating around the U.S." Now, Butts has since deleted the tweet and apologized for sharing the map without reading it closely. The offensive meme map refers to certain parts of the U.S. with offensive names, such as White Congo for Texas, or Whiter Congo for Kentucky, and Christian Iraq for the main part of the southeast of the U.S. Now, this was among other pejoratives such as Narcotic Central for Louisiana, Rape Central for Alaska, Schizophrenia for Nebraska, and Redneck Calgary for Montana. Now, in this, it's typically uncharacteristic for a Canadian political figure who had key roles in both Trudeau campaigns, campaigns, of course, which put progressive ideals in the forefront, nonetheless, to tweet something so blatantly insulting of Canada's top ally and trading partner. Now, given our BC story highlight of cancel culture, you'd have to wonder where the screaming hordes are for Butts to lose his job for sharing a racist tweet as they were for Michael Kornberg. But initially, Butts didn't even apologize for the tweet. Only when he was called out for deleting it did he end up saying that he was, quote, mortified that he had posted the tweet, saying that it was, quote, a mistake to post it without reading it more closely. Now, the problem with this line is that you'd be hard-pressed to not see the clear racism of the map, even at a glance. It's a weak apology at best. However, this wasn't even the worst thing to come out of the Liberal Party this week. 2 weeks ago, we detailed the story of Ontario Liberal MP Marwan Tabara, who was arrested on charges of assault, stalking, and criminal harassment. Now, since the news broke and we covered the story, we have found out that the Liberal Party was doing their own investigation on Tabara since before last election, and yet still allowed him to run for the Liberals. Now, Tabara has since resigned from the Liberal caucus and is now sitting as an independent MP instead of resigning as an MP completely for his behavior. Now, the Liberals had looked into detailed allegations of misconduct made against Tabara that included inappropriate touching and unwelcome sexual comments directed at a female staffer. Now, these allegations date all the way back to the 2015 election campaign, which Tabara was first running in. Now, the party's internal investigation determines that some of the allegations were substantiated. We don't know whether or not Tabara faced any consequences. Given that he was still allowed to run for MP last October, probably not. But his re-election was still allowed to go through despite Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's stated zero-tolerance policy on sexual misconduct in the workplace. Now, the decision to clear Tabara to run as a Liberal took the party's Greenlight Committee more than 6 months to make, which is an unusually long period of time for an incumbent which has already undergone vetting. Now, Tabara, who is the past chair of the Commons Committee on International Human Rights, has now stepped away from the Liberal caucus, but is still working as an MP. Now, the Liberal Party may not have been warned about the criminal charges, as Guelph police did not publicize the details, but it did know about the misconduct allegations dating back to 2015. Claims about inappropriate behavior involving Tabara and the female staffer were reported to the Liberal Party multiple times over the past 5 years. Senior decision makers in both the Trudeau government and the Liberal Party knew about the claims, one of which is an individual who was aware of the allegations is now working in the Prime Minister's office. Now, the party did not take the alleged misconduct seriously until very recently. Now, Trudeau was pressed for answers by reporters at a press conference, and he said that he is continually informed of investigations into allegations against members of his party, but he wouldn't say exactly when he was told about Tabara's case or why Tabara was approved to run in the last election. His answer was the usual political runaround with little substance, with so many words saying so little. He said, quote, "Whenever there are allegations against members of the Liberal Party, part of the process is for the leader to be informed. At the same time, the process that kicks in is a rigorous process that has been established to ensure that every single allegation or complaint around misconduct is appropriately dealt with, and that there are conclusions and next steps for recommendations that are fulfilled." Which doesn't really mean much. Trudeau said Friday that his party takes, quote, extremely seriously any allegations of sexual harassment, but didn't say whether his previous zero-tolerance policy remains in place. Because rather than cite the policy when questioned about Tabara, Trudeau refused to discuss the matter on the basis that it's confidential. Now, one of the biggest problems with Trudeau is that his many slogans all turn out to be false, one after another. Canada is Back suffered a serious embarrassment when Trudeau's bid for his temporary seat on the UN Security Council placed third among three contenders, even after he dedicated years and millions of dollars to enthusiastic lobbying. His slogan, Because It's 2015, which was his famous touting of his feminist credentials, ran aground over his shoddy treatment of Jane Philpott and Jody Wilson-Raybould, two talented female ministers who dared resist his demand for unquestioning deference. And now, zero tolerance, that one has run into trouble as well. It hit problems early on with his treatment of Newfoundland and Labrador MP Scott Andrews and Montreal MP Massimo Pacetti on the basis of complaints from a New Democrat MP about personal misconduct. Both denied the allegations but had their political careers ended anyways. Trudeau at the time said, it's 2014, a variation on his theme, and he said that, quote, the action must be fair but decisive. It must be sensitive to all affected parties, but recognizing how difficult it is to do so, it must give the benefit of the doubt to those who come forward. Now, benefit of the doubt to those who come forward lasted only a few years until he was accused of groping a female journalist before launching his political career. In that case, the Prime Minister first insisted that he didn't remember the incident, then he argued that he didn't feel that he had acted inappropriately, and then finally argued that, quote, often a man experiences an interaction as being benign or not appropriate, and a woman, particularly in a professional context, can experience it differently. So he didn't actually say that it was his fault. Now, despite a House of Commons rule requiring notification if an MP is arrested, Trudeau and his public safety minister, Bill Blair, claimed that they had no knowledge of the charges against Tabara until 2 months later, which Trudeau mused that, quote, there's perhaps a reflection that is something we can look into. And quite frankly, this is unacceptable. If politicians are accused of crimes, and especially convicted of crimes, their constituents deserve to know. If Tabara's arrest and charges weren't disclosed, how would anyone would know to cover this trial if it got to that point? And if he was found to be guilty, would anyone be there to report on that? Now, we know that the party investigated allegations of this inappropriate touching and unwelcome sexual comments directed at the female staffer dated back to the 2015 campaign, but they approved it anyways, and they approved Tabara to run under the Liberal banner, and they didn't take the allegations seriously. Now, you don't need x-ray vision to spot that a rigorous process that leads to next steps and recommendation is a long way from zero tolerance and giving the benefit of the doubt to those who come forward. In the cases of Pacetti and Andrews, Trudeau was so keen on openness that he went public with the claims without thinking to inform the victims, who had wanted to keep them confidential. Now, apparently, he can't possibly comment on allegations against Tabara for fear of violating confidentiality, even though the charges are already spelled out in headlines, and Tabara himself has stated that he's receiving, quote, counseling and treatment for anxiety and depression. Now, this all raises a more troubling question, which is how might history have unfolded if the Liberal Party had actually taken those allegations seriously last year? And what became the investigation once the election was over? If the criminal allegations are ultimately proven in court, then this whole matter could become a lot more unsettling than it already is. But in the meantime, though, the public deserves far more in the way of answers than we've received so far, and there's been far too much secrecy, and it creates an aura of favorable treatment and double standards. As with so many other firm positions adopted by the Trudeau Liberals, the policy on abuse allegations has proven to be easily shifted. When Trudeau was protesting about dealing with allegations against another Liberal, Kent Hare, who was accused of making lewd comments to women, he said, quote, I don't have a rule book that's been handed down by Wilfrid Laurier on how to handle these situations. He said, this is new for organizations to have to deal with this in this way, and we're doing the best that we can on a case-by-case basis. Now, it may just be a coincidence that the need for compromise and understanding has failed to seize the Prime Minister until after he realized that zero tolerance could be a problem for himself and his other party members. Believing women is one thing, but it's something altogether when it impacts men that you know.
Yeah, and this entire story is a definition of Justin Trudeau's double standards. Whether it be with him and Butts and how the allegations of the MP in the last election was handled, it's all a double standard, and it's one rule that he prefers to run his party by and govern his friends by. But when it comes to other people, there's other rules that are entirely different. And, you know, that's something that the media should be talking about. And as you rightly mentioned, the talk of what exactly was going to happen with this case, you know, would the media even be there to report on it? That's a question. It seems as though that all these allegations that just appear at one point, the MP resigns, and then we move on. There's never any follow-up from the media on that. And, you know, because of that, it would be nice to see a follow-up on, you know, what exactly happened with these cases. Did the MPs move on? Did they resign? Were they proven innocent? Were they proven guilty? So on and so forth. Or is, you know, in some cases, as we mentioned on the episode when we first broke this story, there was Conservative MP Tony Clement. He wound up resigning as an MP and not running again. And we'll have to wait and see what happens in the cases of Marwan Tabora in this case. But in any case, the difference in the set of double standards is abundantly clear.
Oh, totally. It's definitely abundantly clear. And this is it's quite clear that there is a double standard for what's going on in the Liberal Party as opposed to what goes on for everyone else. There's quite clearly a set of rules for Trudeau and his friends and his political allies to follow, and another trend for everyone else to follow. And as we've seen here with Gerald Butts, with his tweets about America, and the quite frankly racist map that he had shared, and the fact that there's been no calls on him for to resign, yet for other people there's calls to resign based on other things. And with Tabora, the fact that the police held it so quiet for so long, when it's an MP who has been elected in a public stance to serve on behalf of the people, it just goes to show that the public wasn't served by the police on this particular regard as well. And the fact that the Trudeau Liberals knew about Tabora's allegations dating back to 2015 on separate occasions, that they knew this was going on, and yet they still welcomed him to run as an MP under their banner, it raises even more questions. And the fact that Trudeau couldn't even give a straight answer on this, when in the past he's been very open to giving straight answers on other abuse allegations, and the fact that he had a zero tolerance policy, now it's in question as to whether it actually exists anymore and to whether he actually believed it in the first place.
Indeed, indeed. And with that, we're going to move on to our firing line, where we're going to ask more questions and follow up on the questions we asked last week. But for those wondering, the firing line is a segment that we talk about a story that was entirely missed in the media, or the media missed an entire angle and covered it very horribly. And this one is one that raised eyebrows from the first time we saw it this week, and it's quite honestly stunning sometimes how the questions we ask on the podcast predate the media cycle. I'm sure our listeners have noticed that. But anyways, this headline says that feds could abandon Meng Wanzhou's case if they wanted to, ex-minister and lawyer. So last week, we of course covered China's indictment of Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor on their espionage charges, as China says. And this week, that story has been blown wide open, and it's followed a very, very odd trajectory. First, Global News and the CBC ran with stories saying that the federal government could end Meng Wanzhou's case if they wanted to. And CBC went even further and asked, should it being the government? Now, with all this came a legal opinion from former federal Justice Minister Alan Rock and former Supreme Court of Canada Justice John Major, stating that Canada could legally end the extradition process for the Huawei CFO, who's been held in Vancouver since late 2018. Well-known Toronto lawyer Brian Greenspan also chimed in, saying that it is clear, in my view, that that's the law, that the Justice Minister may intervene at this stage. Then after all these lawyers and prominent Canadians chimed in, a group of 19 Canadians wrote a letter to Justin Trudeau urging him to do just that. Their opinion in the letter is that we should do that because, first, they're ultimately worried about the physical, mental, and emotional health of the two Michaels held in China. Second, they see the Meng Wanzhou case as making it impossible for the government of Canada to define and pursue an effective foreign policy towards China. And quite frankly, here at Western Context, we saw that go out the door when Trudeau walked into China with the progressive trade agenda. Third, Brian Greenspan said so, and it would be in accordance with the rule of law. That's what their third reason is in the letter, actually. And finally, they say it's past due for the Prime Minister to do that, as they just said. Now, they also say that in normal circumstances, the safer choice would be for Canada to stay close to our ally, our friend, our principal trading partner, otherwise known as the United States. But these are not normal times. These Canadians, in this letter, are encouraging the Prime Minister and Government of Canada to pursue a close relationship with a dictatorship rather than the United States because of Huawei, the two Michaels, and what can only be read in the letter as the fact that Donald Trump is the President of the United States. Some other Canadians on this list include Ed Broadbent, who is a former leader of the NDP, Derek Burney, a former Canadian ambassador to the U.S., and former chief of staff to Brian Mulroney, Lawrence Cannon, a former foreign affairs minister and ambassador to France, Robert Fowler, a former foreign policy advisor to Prime Ministers Trudeau Sr., Turner, and Mulroney, Don Newman, a journalist, and Alan Rock, former justice minister and attorney general. Now, the question that first appeared is what indeed brought this up? It turns out that this was brought up by the wife of one of the Michaels who sought a legal opinion, and then it snowballed from there. But, as with most things in this day and age, we shouldn't take that at face value. It was also revealed this week that CSIS, our national spy agency, believes that Canada is a permissive target for Chinese influence. They list our foundations of our fundamental institutions, including our system of democracy itself, as prime targets for influence. And they also suggest that the Chinese Communist Party has won the support of some influential Canadians by using economic carrots and sticks. They also rightly point out that the public attention on Beijing's influence is almost non-existent. Because where have you heard about the foreign influence of the Chinese Communist Party being pushed on Canada? Nowhere. Global News interviewed Liberal MP David McGuinty, who is the chair of the National Security and Intelligence Committee, and he said that the People's Republic of China utilizes its growing economic wealth to mobilize interference operations with deep coffers and the help of Western enablers. The Chinese Communist Party uses money, rather than communist ideology, as a powerful source of influence, creating parasitic relationships of long-term dependence. Now, it's worth noting that these aren't David McGuinty's own words. He was quoting from a report that his committee has drafted. The report also names Russia along with China, but intelligence officials and former diplomats believe that China is the greater threat. David Mulroney, a former ambassador to China, has said that China has used its economic leverage to secure the voices, as he says, of political and business leaders in Canada with sweetheart business deals and various inducements, including lucrative board positions or honors in China, which when you think about it, that's a pretty big deal. The report also mentions the United Front, which influences the Chinese diaspora, which we talked about back on Western Context, episode 171, and it's also thought that the United Front is aggressively lobbying many elected officials for Beijing's policies and actually taking funding from Beijing and attempting to promote covert Chinese Communist Party members for election in Canada. That's right. Now, of course, looking at other countries, Australia has tried to combat China and as a result has seen Chinese tariffs slapped on Australian exports. What's clear now is there needs to be a full inquiry into Chinese influence within the Canadian government, including but not limited to how many elected officials have been lobbied, how many members of cabinet have been influenced, how effective they have been, and most importantly, what steps can Canada, as part of the greater G7, take to combat this foreign influence by the Chinese Communist Party. China is not a country to be taken lightly. And this is why this letter and the push to free Meng Wanzhou is deeply concerning for all Canadians.
Yes, exactly. It's concerning. It's especially concerning because this group, formerly powerful people that still could be influencing our society today, are trying to come together and make a mockery of our justice system. And our justice system relies on the rule of law and whether laws are broken. And this whole case, it revolves around that. And with Meng Wanzhou, it has to deal with the fact that Huawei was breaking international laws. And it's not just laws in the U.S. that were broken, so we can't just hand her off to the United States and have and be done with it. And we can't just give her back to China, because then Canada would be breaking the law in that sense. And they have to determine whether laws are broken, and they have to come to a judgment on this. And that takes time. Unfortunately, it's been taking enough time that the hostages that China has taken in the meantime, the two Michaels, have now been held for over 550 days in Chinese isolation prison and undergone various torture methods to try and break them. Thankfully, they're, as we've last heard, have remained strong. But as time goes on, it makes it even worse. And the fact that they're wanting to hand Meng Wanzhou back to China without any guarantee that the Michaels would even return is very dangerous for Canada. And the fact that if Canada reneges on its rule of law, once we do that once, you can't go back. And that's a decision not to be made lightly.
And that's precisely what China would like to happen in this case. And it proves not just to China but other countries that if you take a couple of Canadians hostage, you'll get something from the Canadian government. It was actually said this week that the Prime Minister said that he has no intention of releasing Meng Wanzhou in exchange for the two Michaels. We'll have to wait and see if the government keeps that stance. And the most explosive thing to come out of this is that China actually admitted this week that they are holding the two Michaels because of this case with Meng Wanzhou. So everything that was thought to be happening with this case was proven right this week. And, you know, as we mentioned, there's lots of uncomfortable questions to be asked. The media isn't asking them. The opposition isn't asking them. And quite frankly, based on the level of influence that CSIS thinks could be possible, it's time for an inquiry to find out what exactly is going on.
Yes, exactly. And we need to have an inquiry into what exactly the level of Chinese influence is in Canada and how much their money and their influence and their ideology is running deep into Canada. And it starts with the government and it heads all the way down to our basic levels of society. And we have to see just how much the Chinese government influence in Canada belongs to, because it's quite clear that they're trying to influence how Canada reacts, especially based on our justice system.
Indeed, indeed. And with that, I think we can move on to our word of the week. And, you know, it really exemplifies what the media likes to talk about, these flashy issues regarding to social media, when in regards you have cases like this Chinese government influence going on, that's just completely flying by the wayside. So what's our word of the week?
So our word of the week this week is cancel culture. Now, cancel culture refers to the social media practice of withdrawing support for or canceling public figures and companies after they have done or said something considered controversial or objectionable. And this could lead anywhere to a boycott of products, or it could lead to calls to fire a person from their job. And we've been seeing a lot more of cancel culture in the last few years, and it's gotten worse over the past couple decades. It probably started back at the turn of the millennium, but it's certainly gotten worse since then. With the rise of social media, we've seen a lot more cancel culture, outrage culture out there since all of these issues have come up. And the problem with cancel culture is that it really promotes divisiveness amongst the population. And that's something that really should not be happening.
Indeed, indeed. And that word can encompass our pretty much most of our stories this week, at least the first three of them, whereas with the fourth one, you have everybody else, of course, focusing in on cancel culture and whether or not too much democracy is a good thing. But on the other hand, you have the story of the Chinese influence, the influence of the Chinese government completely flying by, and what exactly this group of Canadians is wanting to happen. So it's fair and wise that everybody who listens to this podcast be aware of what cancel culture is. And if you want to learn more about all of our stories that we talked about this week, you can find those in our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, which its app is banned in China, all of that and more at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook, where we share the shows and some of the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all the stories that the media is talking about and some that they don't talk about, no matter what it's about, to make sure that you have the context needed to put yourselves on the bright side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.